Thank you very much for your nice introduction. That was really better than I could have said. So today I'm going to tell you something about...
So down is forward.
Down is forward. Okay, let's see if I can control it. I'm going to tell you something about how gravity can modify thermodynamics. So this work is based on these two papers that I wrote with...
Yes. Is this up or down?
It is on.
It is on, so...
Hello?
It's working, so...
So these two papers were written... So one was written with Dechang Dai, he's my postdoc, and another one with Ruifeng Dong, he's my graduate student. So what's the motivation for this work? So thermodynamics is certainly a very well understood branch of physics. But not so if you include gravity in it, like black holes, De Sitter space, anti-De Sitter space, and so on. Most of the time, we do apply the laws of thermodynamics naively to the systems of gravity, but then usually we get confused, just like information loss paradox, initial conditions for the beginning of the universe and so on and so on. So there are strong indications that gravity can make crucial changes into thermodynamical systems, especially in strong gravity regime, like the presence of black holes. So we don't have concrete calculations so far about this, especially for the examples that I would like to discuss here, where gravity actually can induce maximal temperature in a thermodynamical system and can modify the Poincaré recurrence theorem. This is the outline of the talk. So I will start with some basic facts about thermodynamics, something that we will need for the discussion. Then I will go to a production of mini black holes in gas of particles, in collisions of particles in the gas. And then I will show that this will directly lead to the maximal temperature that can be achieved in a thermodynamical system. Then I will go to the Poincaré recurrence theorem. And I will discuss two cases, Poincaré recurrence theorem when you include gravity, but in classical case. And the other case, the other relevant case, will be Poincaré recurrence theorem with gravity, but in quantum case. These are two substantially different cases because degrees of freedom are different. Okay. So let's start from the very beginning. As we already mentioned, thermodynamics is not an active field of research. Boltzmann, Gibbs, Kelvin, Helmholtz, they established the rules of thermodynamics, which are still unchallenged. However, the drawback is that the laws of gravity are not included. But it's pretty simple to see that gravity actually makes crucial difference. So if you take a system, let's say a box of particles, and let's say you start with this state and you don't touch it, the evolution, the spontaneous evolution, will lead it to this state. But when you include gravity, exactly the opposite will happen. So you start with this state, with box of particles in an equilibrium configuration. Then you include gravity, then spontaneous evolution will take it to this state. So obviously gravity does something different than system without gravity. Okay? So if we start with the usual definition of a temperature, the temperature is a measure of kinetic energy of the particles in the system. Then Lord Kelvin, in mid-1880s, taught us that the lowest possible temperature in a system is when the particles stop moving. You can't get any lower than that. That's the lowest one. So let's just name it. That's T equal to zero. So that's absolute zero. And that's the lowest temperature that can be achieved in a thermodynamical system. Okay. But what about the maximal temperature? So is there an upper limit to a temperature which can be achieved in a thermodynamical system? In the context of Newtonian physics, no, because... Sorry. Because there's no upper limit on kinetic energy in Newtonian physics. So you can go up to infinitely high energies. What if you include special relativity? Velocity is bounded from above, but energy is still not bounded from above. So still, even when you include special relativity into account, there is no upper limit on the temperature in a thermodynamical system. So, okay, let's include gravity. So if we include classical gravity, still no upper limit on kinetic energy. But we do know that the validity of classical gravity is limited by the Planck scale, which is 10 to the 19 GeV. If you really want it in Kelvin, that's 10 to the 32 Kelvin. So we usually say, especially in cosmology, maximal temperature that you can reasonably talk about is around T Planck, which is 10 to the 32 Kelvin. But notice that there's no dynamics which is going to enforce this limit. This is an arbitrary cutoff. We just cut off our theory there and we say it doesn't make sense to talk about temperature, any temperatures higher than this. Okay? So this is just our ignorance. Then when we start talking about black holes, then one of the things that you first realize is that you can't pack too much energy in a small volume. So if you have a system with a volume V and energy density rho, the total mass of the system is just rho times V over C squared, if you want the units right. Schwarzschild radius, which is associated with this total mass, is 2gm over C squared. And condition that the system is not within its own Schwarzschild radius is just 2gm over C squared is smaller than volume 2,1 over 3. Okay. So that you don't make a black hole out of it. Since the temperatures that we are going to talk about here today are very high temperatures, I can safely assume that we are going to talk about radiation. So all the particles are highly relativistic. So energy density is proportional to T4, T to the fourth power. Just plug it there. Plug this energy density there. Replace, so substitute M here. And you get the relationship between the maximal temperature that you can achieve in a system and the volume of the system. So there's a bunch of constants here. What's relevant is that maximal temperature is volume to minus 1 over 6. What does that mean? We can maximize the temperature in a system by minimizing the volume. Again, we can play the same game and say the minimal volume that makes sense talking about is the Planck volume. So cut it off at the Planck volume, and then you get that the maximal temperature is Planckian temperature. But again, it's a cutoff. It's a result of our ignorance. So what if tomorrow we discover a self-consistent, fully fledged self-consistent theory of quantum gravity, and we actually learn that we can actually talk about arbitrarily small volumes? Then if volume tends to zero, maximal temperature that can be achieved is infinite. So the point of today's talk is actually that there is a dynamical mechanism which will limit the temperature of the system. So the dynamics of the internal dynamics of the system will inevitably lead to a maximal temperature, and you don't have to do any cutoffs because of some unknown physics. So today I'm going to use just the known physics. So I'm just going to use thermodynamics, statistical physics, and classical general relativity. Okay? And that mechanism will be mini black hole production in collisions of particles. So I'm not sure if the animation is visible, probably not. There should be a bunch of particles here, which is the gas. So this.
Is there?
You can see it here. No, it's okay, no problem. It's just an illustration. I can say it in words. Yeah, you can see some particles. Yeah. So what's the point? You have a lot of particles in the gas. They are colliding all the time. Probability that they will make a black hole is very low. But then, as you keep increasing the temperature, you're going to produce more and more of these black holes. At certain point, you have more black holes than particles in the system. At that point, your system breaks down. You can't heat it up anymore. any additional energy that you put in a system will go into black holes, not into particles. So it is as simple as that. The thing is that, okay, let's calculate. So what happens when you have collision of two particles with certain center of mass energy? Sorry, I clicked it again. So if you collide two particles, and if impact parameter B, impact parameter is the shortest distance between these two particles, is smaller than 2 times the Schwarzschild radius, actually Schwarzschild diameter, for a given center of mass energy, then according to a Hoppe conjecture, or a modified version of a Hoppe conjecture, a black hole with mass which is equal to the center of mass energy in collision of these two particles will form. Okay. So again, Schwarzschild radius associated with mass m is just 2gm over c squared. Take two particles with momenta k1 and k2, and they are colliding under certain angle theta. The center of mass energy of these two particles is just this. It depends on masses of particles, their momenta, and collision angle. Okay? Schwarzschild radius associated with this mass is this. Fine. So this is how you make one black hole when you collide two particles with center of mass energy which is close to Planckian. But as we said, as you increase the temperature, collisions are more and more violent. So at a certain point, you have more black holes than the particles, and the system will break down. So we can't increase the temperature any further.
So are you imagining a system as some sort of equilibrium when you say a black hole?
Yeah, equilibrium. As long as you have a temperature, I mean, there must be an equilibrium.
So or, the idea that black holes are evaporating then?
Yeah, yeah, that's a very important point. It will be covered. It will be covered. Okay, so any additional energy would be dumped into black holes, not gas. Okay?
Can we not put extra energy to this gas of mini black holes?
Yeah, but what will happen then? The black holes will merge and make one big black hole. You still can't heat it up. And when you increase the mass of the black hole, its Hawking radiation goes down. Because Hawking radiation is inversely proportional to the mass of the black hole. Okay? So this is going to define my critical temperature. The temperature at which number density of black holes is greater than number density of particles in the system. So that's TC. Okay, so let's do the calculations, and I can tell you even in advance that it's so simple, a third year undergraduate student can do that after he takes a statistical mechanics course. So single out one particle with momentum K1. That's this one. The volume inside the Schwarzschild diameter is just this. So that's Schwarzschild diameter cubed. Within this volume, you want to see how many particles with momentum K2 you have. So that's just the volume times number density of particles with momentum K2. So obviously, you need some distribution function. The simplest system, bosons, massless bosons. You use Bose-Einstein distribution function. Plug it there, and you get the particle number density, which is determined from this distribution function. Okay? So that's when you single out one particle with momentum K1. But now you have to integrate over all of the particles with momentum K1. So there is another distribution function here. Since these are massless particles, so energy and momentum, these are the same thing. So K is equal to E. Schwarzschild radius for a given center of mass energy in a collision of these two particles was given on a previous slide. So everything is determined here. You just have to integrate.
You don't distinguish whether particles come this way or that way.
It will depend on theta. So yeah, it will depend on theta. So your result will depend on theta. Okay. There is one factor which takes care of overcounting, which is 1/2. That's this factor here. And another thing, I'm not sure if this is your question. See, the center of mass energy in which you are producing black hole will depend on theta. So your result is theta dependent. So your mass will go actually from zero to certain maximal mass depending on what your theta is. So if theta is whatever, zero, then the mass will be maximal. If theta is whatever, pi, then the mass will be minimal or something like that.
How do you infer that black holes are bosons?
No. The system of particles, so the particles are bosons. So I calculate the probability that a black hole of mass M will be formed.
No, I mean you use the Bose distribution.
For particles in the gas. So particles in the gas are colliding and making black holes. So I describe my particles in the gas as bosons. But once I make a black hole, we'll see what happens. So we will see that at these temperatures, I mean, since you're asking the question, let me just jump, but it will be explained a couple of slides later.
Okay.
But it seems that you're not computing the rate of formation of black holes, you're computing the steady state.
Yeah, number density. In the second part, when I'm going to talk about Poincaré recurrence theorem, then the rate will be important. Because I have to compare a rate with a rate. A rate production rate of black holes with Poincaré recurrence rate. Right now.
But classically, what happens is just you keep forming more and more black holes. You don't get to reach a steady state. Right? Because
yeah, but okay. Okay, so should I? Okay. If you're not still happy in three slides, then you can ask me a question. So let's integrate this. And it's very nice that you can integrate it exactly. You do have some Riemann zeta functions here and some fundamental constants, but number density of black holes grows as t to the 9 very quickly with temperature. However, what's the problem? Gravity is very weak, and you have g to the third degree. So you have to overcome a huge suppression because of the weakness of gravity. But see, it grows as t to the 9. Compare it with the number density of particles, which is defined as just t to the cube, and you see that number of black holes grows much faster than number density of particles. Okay. So let's calculate the critical temperature. So at certain point, number of black holes is the same as number of particles, and as you pointed out, it will just keep growing. It will overshoot it. But at the moment when these are equal, that's my critical temperature. The expression for this critical temperature, again, a bunch of constants in front, that you can plug the values for, and then you get 4.27 times 10 to the 31 Kelvin. Compare it with the Planck temperature, which is 1.42 times 10 to the 32 Kelvin, it's 3 times lower. I mean, it's almost there, but not quite, which is important.
Well, sorry, I thought you were, on all these things, you're ignoring gravitational back reaction until they get close enough to form a black hole.
Yeah,
so
it's just a sub
order of magnitude estimates.
It's a Hoop conjecture, yeah. So
no, but I mean all these expressions, if you actually took into account gravitational back reaction, are much more complicated. And I don't blame you for not doing that, but if you want to then say I'm going to take this factor of 3 seriously, then I'm confused as the...
Technically, you're right. I mean, seriously. But what I wanted to show that I didn't get anything of exactly T Planck or higher than T Planck. So this is going to happen at the temperature which is lower than T Planck. So I agree. You would need the corrections, but okay. So that's actually this line, this point that I'm making here. So any corrections will actually go... Sorry. Any corrections to this result? So it's 3 times lower than T Planck. So any corrections, linear corrections to this result, will be about 30%. Quadratic corrections will be about 10%. So if I got a number here which is like 0.9 T Planck, then I agree. So any small corrections, will invalidate the conclusions here.
No, but even the Hoop conjecture is a very Planck wave thing.
So you could have, you could draw a minimum factor of two there, and it would be fine, and it could go either way. So I think Keith's point still stands. You're going to be very, very careful and say, oh,
yeah, I agree with that.
I think you do have a problem.
I agree. The philosophy here is okay. Take all of the known factors that you can. So everything that you know how to calculate with the best precision that you can, put it there and see what you get. So of course, there is always some extra factor here and there that could have invalidated that. But again, everything that we know here, when you put it there, you get 0.3 t-plank. So that's the point.
You could have gotten 3, and I think it wouldn't invalidate anything you're saying. If you're so fixated of it being smaller than t-plank, I don't think you could claim, oh, this is a successful calculation because it is smaller than t-plank.
It's a good indication. If I got greater than t-plank, then I can throw everything in garbage. But the fact that we got it less than t-plank.
That's a high bar for you, I mean, you're putting yourself in a very, very strict requirement. Because I think if one were to look at these numbers with care, you could easily get it.
Yeah, or smaller, or smaller. Yeah. No, I'm aware of it, of course. But the philosophy here is put everything that you can with the known physics and see what you get. Okay.
So, what quantum gravity theory do you use? Okay.
No, unknown corrections. So who knows what? As he said, whatever. When you're colliding two particles with energy close to Planckian, you're going to deform the space-time. So that's related to what he said. The Hoppe conjecture may not say that you're going to. I mean, the Hoppe conjecture is just a conjecture. It may happen that the mass of the black hole that you make is not exactly m that I wrote there. It's half m, or 0.9 m, or 1.3 m. So that's what I mean. So all of the unknown things that can modify your result.
Actually, something that could help this discussion is if instead of one species, you have several species of bosons. So there would be a g factor in front, which could be big. I don't know actually which direction that goes.
Yeah, because then you have more collisions, more black holes. You don't know which direction it will go.
But yeah, so
I think it will help black holes.
But if you could have a big G, that could help, then maybe this wouldn't be a problem, but it could be sub-Planckian. It would be interesting to know whether this transition depends on that number of bosons.
I agree with all the comments that were made so far. So you can push this number up or down, but again.
Can you clarify, so you do not include so far in computations the Hawking radiation?
Yeah, it will be next slide.
Because if you do, right, you can raise the temperature arbitrarily high, just letting black holes to evaporate and get small. And once again, you're there.
No. As the temperature grows, you are producing heavier and heavier black holes. So
as my black hole evaporates, it gets smaller and smaller, and its temperature rises. And there is nothing to
stop
me unless I include higher derivative correction. So if I include higher derivative correction, I just let those black holes evaporate.
No. There will be accretion. Sorry. There will be competition between accretion and evaporation. So it can't evaporate to arbitrarily low mass because as soon as it hits the temperature of the gas, then it will start accreting. So no, it can disappear. But that's next slide. That's next slide. So I just wanted to show what is going on here. So. The number density of black holes starts very low, but it grows very quickly. The number density of particles is just t cubed. So at certain point, they have to intersect. So we calculated that they intersect here. Then they could intersect here or there. I mean, if you want to go all the way to t Planck, which is somewhere here, 99% of the content of the gas will be black holes. You will have 99% of black holes and 1% of particles.
What mass do these black holes have?
So, most of the black holes that will survive here are right at the threshold. See, you can do this. So this is what everybody is asking. Not everybody, but several questions. Black holes evaporate. So, we can count only those black holes which are colder than the gas. Because only they will survive and stay in the system. So you can do easy Monte Carlo integration, numerical integration. The way I kept it simple is that because you get exact results. So you can integrate it analytically and get the number here. The right way to do it is to do Monte Carlo and keep only those black holes which are colder than the gas, which means mass is sufficiently big so that its Hawking temperature is lower than the temperature of the gas. Because these black holes are not going to disappear. They're going to stay there and keep accreting particles. That's one thing. That practically answers your question. What's the mass? So black holes at this temperature, the critical temperature, where you have more black holes than particles, is close to Planck mass, but bigger than that, because temperature is 1 over Planck mass, so that the temperature is colder than this. So most of the black holes at the critical temperature are black holes heavier than Planck mass, which is pretty important because we can treat black holes lighter than Planck mass. But the way to do it, I mean, either you do Monte Carlo integration, so you form a black hole, check its mass according to the center of mass energy of two particles. If it's hotter than the gas, throw it away and keep only black holes which are colder than the gas. Or you can do something smarter. Mass of the black hole depends on the collision angle. So as theta goes from 0 to pi, center of mass energy goes from 0 to certain maximal energy. So if you want to exclude very light black holes, which are dangerous for you, then you're just going to limit your theta integration. So in your integrals, you don't integral don't take an integral from 0 to pi. You take an integral for some theta minimum, which is this to pi. But what you're going to see, so now you replot with this limit, you replot, and you don't see any difference. So that's an indication that at this temperature, most of the black holes, if not all of them, they're colder than the gas. They're big enough, massive enough, so that they will survive. They will stay there.
So the one solar mass black hole takes...
No, not solar mass.
10 to the 67 years to evaporate. So if you... 1 gram would take...
this is not gram, this is...
minus 10 to the 32 years to evaporate.
This is not gram. I mean, it will be a gram if you take a microscopic system.
Exceedingly long time.
He's talking about Planckian black holes, so these are very different regime.
Planck, you said one.
T Planck.
One,
T Planck, that's 10 to the minus 5 grams.
Planck mass is 10 to the minus 5 grams?
Yeah.
So I was right. It's going to take a long time. This is beyond. The point is that this is beyond experimental physics.
It's a thought experiment.
Probably never.
Of course, you have to heat up your gas to T Planck. Of course.
That may happen.
Yeah?
Sorry, I guess I'm confused about something more simple. So when I talk about thermodynamics, I'm thinking about system in equilibrium. Now here, you have a system which has two components, whatever, a distribution of black holes plus some normal particles. Now you know that black holes have a negative specific heat.
Yeah.
So what I have, I basically have a mixture of two subsystems that are never in equilibrium with each other. I don't even know how to define temperature in that case. And in fact, what is going to happen is that's why I have been pushing you to thinking about small black holes, because they get hotter, so they can, you know, they can. Naively, normally in thermodynamics, there is an energy flow from hotter objects to cooler objects. But again, I'm confused even how to think about thermodynamics in a context when my system is never in equilibrium.
Yeah, so yeah, first of all, you are right. If you can improve this just by doing like a detailed balance. But that will be, I mean, detailed balance equations. Because you have gas, you have accretion, you have evaporation. So you have gas, you have black holes, and you have change of energy between them. You can do the detailed balance.
So exactly what you're saying, that's non-equilibrium process. There is no concept of temperature when I have a non-equilibrium process.
Again.
I had a very similar question. If you even just take a gas in a uniform gravitational field,
Yeah.
Equilibrium is not a constant temperature. The Tolman-Ehrenfest effect tells you it's hotter near the bottom than at the top.
Yeah.
And so equilibrium is a completely different notion.
Okay, so strictly speaking, that's correct. That's correct. But what are we doing here? So in one regime, gas dominates absolutely the system. Here. So that's where your distribution function is valid and everything is correct. At the other end, the black holes will totally dominate the system. They must cross somewhere in between. And again, if you do an honest to God calculation, so who knows what you're going to get, you're going to move these numbers left and right. But they have to cross somewhere. And I said, okay, put just everything that we know and calculate that number. So what you proposed is correct. The best way to do it is to take, so you take the gas, you take black holes. Okay, so you have particles which are making black holes. These black holes are very light. They will start evaporating. So they will start repopulating particles, but they will also eating particles in accretion. So they will be exchanging energy. So it's a dynamical system. Why you can't do that here? Because you are not going to produce black holes of one mass. Then maybe you can do the problem. But you have a spectrum of masses present in the gas.
A lot of discussion depends on, you know, some things that you are putting up as a rock, which is what's happening with the box, right? So does your box has reflecting boundary conditions, or does it allow the radiation to escape? And then we are going to the discussion whether we are, say, in Minkowski space or, you know, effectively in anti-de Sitter space. And the dynamics of black holes is very different. For example, in ADS,
Black
holes can be in the
unstable equilibrium.
And over here, they are not. So it's really all these questions are crucially depend on lots of details. And you are going back to the points made earlier. You are arguing that 0.3 is a big, you know, a factor of 2. I would say, you know, it can be a factor of 10 to 100 or something. Well, I don't really, wouldn't trust any of these. T-critical or something.
So let me suggest that we move on a little bit, see what else there is.
Yeah.
We could criticize some more.
There is. We wrote another paper. We did exactly the same thing in ADS. So there is another paper, but I just didn't include it here. So we did it in ADS. So then you get orders of magnitude are the same, though now we have another scale. But OK, we can discuss that later. So. But let's go to the second part of the talk, which is Poincaré recurrence. Okay, so Henri Poincaré in 1890 proved the theorem that a fixed system, bounded phase space, so it's not infinite space, it's not infinite number of degrees of freedom, will eventually return arbitrarily close to any given initial configuration. Okay, so what's the problem with this? The problem is this entropy must also return to its original value. So if it increases during one period of time, it has to decrease during another period of time. But second law of thermodynamics is telling you that entropy should always increase in time. So Boltzmann proved his famous H theorem. So if you define a function which is just pk logarithm pk, where pk is the probability to access the state labeled by a number k, and you then assume Newton's laws of motion, then you can prove that this function never increases. If h never increases, that then minus h never decreases. Therefore, he identified it as entropy, and he wrote down that entropy is just minus Boltzmann constant times the h function. But then Zermelo, a little bit later, said, okay, he knew about the Poincaré recurrence theorem. So you proved it that it never decreases, but because of Poincaré result, we know that it has to decrease, therefore your work is not correct. Therefore, this can't be entropy. And after a fit of mental depression, Boltzmann committed suicide. He probably should not have done that, because we understand this a little bit better. Recurrences are completely consistent with the statistical viewpoint. They are fluctuations, which are certain to occur if you wait long enough. So probability for a fluctuation is proportional to the change in entropy, so e to the minus change in entropy. So if you're changing entropy a lot, these fluctuations are suppressed. If you change entropy a little bit, suppression is lower. But unless change in entropy is infinite, any fluctuation will happen after a long, long time. So this state will go to this state because of ds by dt is always greater than zero. But if you wait long, 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 long time, some fluctuation can take you back to this state. So given enough time, simple system will simple every possible state which is available. Such reasoning demystifies Poincaré recurrences but introduces other problems that I'm not going to discuss here. I just flashed them. So like Boltzmann-Brain problems, the minimal fluctuation which is consistent with all of the observations is a single brain with false impressions and memories of the previous existence. The other one is the origin of the universe problem. So if observed cosmological constant lambda is a true cosmological constant, then equilibrium configuration of maximal entropy is this one, entropy of the sitter, which is 10 to 120. Then you look at the entropy of the Big Bang and entropy today versus entropy of inflation. So out of equilibrium fluctuation required for creation of our universe is much more likely to produce directly this guy or this guy than inflation. So it's not quite clear what is going on here. That's why at the beginning I said, so once we include gravity into thermodynamics and statistical physics, we don't really know what is going on.
Sorry, on the first line there, you're including cosmological horizon entropy, but the second one you're excluding?
Where?
When you're saying S consider, I assume that's cosmological
horizon. Yeah, yeah. That's the so assuming that that's true cosmological constant, maximal entropy that you can fit there is this one, yeah?
So by that, by an S consider, you mean the cosmological horizon entropy, or do you mean
yeah.
Else?
Yeah, 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 cosmological, okay. Yeah, yeah, cosmological.
But in the, why are you then excluding cosmological horizon entropy in the lower cases?
You mean here?
Yeah.
No, this is the maximal, that's the equilibrium. So if you started from equilibrium as a fluctuation, so you started with this, with maximal, that's your equilibrium. That's your state of maximal entropy. That's the generic state.
I don't think this makes any sense, but keep on going in view of time.
Earlier, the horizon was smaller, so that number is not relevant. That's only when you reach that
horizon. Well, sorry, you need to compare like with like. So you know, the universe is whatever size, if you want to compare entropy. I'm comparing now to a realm of
real. Yeah, you're just, yeah. You are asking the questions which are relevant. Papers are written on this. Do you count total entropy everywhere or just available entropy within a horizon? Again, we can discuss this, just this. You can make like five talks just about this slide. I don't want to discuss it.
There's some things that are, yeah. Okay, I don't understand how this makes any sense, but keep on going in view of time.
Yeah, because
that's we. That's the problem, but yeah. Nobody understands.
Yeah.
Well, some of us think we do, or at least maybe.
Okay, so but what if you include gravity? Poincaré recurrence time is enormous. It's e to the entropy times t Planck. And I just introduced another mechanism that people neglected so far. I mean, there is practically no discussion about the effect that I was talking about today. That particles are going to produce black holes in their collisions. So at low temperature, of course, these processes are suppressed. But given enough time, particles from the tails of distribution will produce mini black holes. So black holes might modify recurrence theorem or even prevent it from happening. We have to distinguish two cases here. Classical case, where we deal with classical phase space, positions and momenta. Entropy is just the classical Gibbs entropy for collection of classical particles. And classical Poincaré recurrence time is given as e to the entropy times t Planck. And in classical gravity, black holes don't evaporate. In quantum case, we're dealing with quantum states. Entropy is quantum from quantum distribution function. Quantum Poincaré recurrence time is double exponential, e to the entropy. And we have to include quantum effects. Black holes evaporate, and also black holes have entropy. Since I lost a lot of time, so let me just hurry up over the basic things. So in classical Poincaré recurrence, we are going to define classical entropy. We are going to plug it into the Poincaré, Poincaré recurrence time. And we are going to compare it with the black hole production rate in collision of two particles. So now instead of number density of black holes, we are calculating the production rate of black holes, which is dn by dt. But the calculation is similar. So you're going to use the black hole production cross-section, the relative velocity between these two particles, and the distribution function that you're going to use. For classical case, the distribution function is the classical Maxwell distribution function. Since I'm going to do numerical calculations here, so I can throw in directly this condition, that mass of the black hole must be greater than Planck mass. So I'm going to keep just the classical black holes there. I'm going to define parameter eta, which is telling me who is winning, Poincaré recurrence or the black hole production rate. If eta is greater than 1, Poincaré recurrence never happens. Okay, this is just analyzing the condition, but let me show you the results. So that's practically the condition which is telling you who is winning. But let's throw some numbers in. So if you have a typical everyday system with, let's say, 1 meter cube of volume and Avogadro number of particles, then the critical temperature is 10 to the 7 Kelvin. So if your system is that hot, if that's the temperature of your system, then you're going to produce black holes. Then the black hole production rate is faster than the Poincaré recurrence rate. So you're producing black holes faster than you're going towards the Poincaré recurrence. If you plug the numbers for the whole universe, you get a nice coincidence that critical temperature is CMB. So if our universe were a system with a fixed volume and number of particles, that would imply that we would never undergo the classical Poincaré recurrence.
Sorry, but is that if you are above this, then you form black holes faster?
Yeah.
Okay.
For the quantum case, we have to deal with Hilbert space, with quantum distribution function, and quantum entropy. And quantum Poincaré recurrence time is a double exponent. We calculate again the production, black hole production rate, but now for the quantum case. Now black holes evaporate, so it's not enough to keep black holes heavier than M Planck. I have to keep them colder than the gas. If they're not, I discard them. Okay. Again, we define eta. Eta greater than 1 means black holes form faster than you go back to initial state. For a system with volume of 1 meter cube, critical temperature is 10 to the minus 2 Kelvin. So you're going to produce black holes faster than you're going towards the recurrence. That's one thing. But now, what's the problem? Black holes are quantum. So they have states themselves. So they can undergo recurrence as well. They have entropy. And the thing is that we produce black holes here, in collisions, not by thermal fluctuations, which means that I can produce black holes even if the process is not thermally favored. So even if entropy goes down when I produce a black hole. So as a result, I can shorten the Poincaré recurrence, not only prolong it. So you have to be careful there, but anyway, you can parameterize it. So before the collision, in which you form the black hole of mass M, entropy of the gas that formed a black hole had this energy. So before the collision, that's the entropy of the gas. After the collision, entropy goes into the mass, energy goes into the mass of black hole. Mass of the black hole is related to temperature of the black hole. So entropy of the gas before the collision was this. You compare it with entropy of the black hole after the collision. And you get a condition that temperature must be less than volume to the minus 1/5. So in such systems which satisfy this, black holes prolong the Poincaré recurrence. Otherwise, they shorten it. Again, throw in some numbers. If you take 1 meter cubed of volume, then a temperature less than 10 to 11 Kelvin, you prolong the Poincaré recurrence. Put again the whole universe there. The critical temperature is 10 to the minus 29 Kelvin. So at that temperature, you will produce black holes faster than Poincaré recurrence time, and you will increase the subsequent Poincaré recurrence because of the states of the black hole. But there is an interesting coincidence there too, that that's the critical temperature that we calculated, but the Sitter space temperature is exactly that temperature. Again, maybe some coincidence, or maybe there is some deeper relation there. There is a caveat. Black holes, once formed, will further evolve. They will merge, they will grow. So if they evolve slow enough, then previous numbers are completely true. We don't have to modify them. But if evolution is fast, then they will merge very quickly and form one big black hole. Then what you're comparing is entropy of the gas with entropy of the final big black hole. Then the numbers work out a little bit differently, then this is the condition. So this is the initial temperature of the gas, which would produce the final large black hole with more entropy than the initial gas, and thus increase the recurrence time. So this is practically everything that I wanted to say here. So behavior of a thermodynamical system can be significantly modified with gravity. Strong gravity effects can appear either at high temperatures or at low temperatures if we wait long enough. So gravity establishes maximal temperature in the system, and gravity modifies Poincaré recurrence theorem. I agree with the objections that some of you raised. Where exactly this is going to happen, okay, I can always move it up and down. But first, nobody discussed this effect so far, and second, it's inevitable to happen at some temperature. At some temperature, you're going to have, the system will break down. So you're going to have more black holes than particles. Or in this case, Poincaré recurrence without gravity must be modified by inclusion of gravity. Again, I haven't seen this discussion anywhere else. And I will stop here.
Before we take questions, so we're going to have a speaker dinner at 6 in the bistro, as always. So, questions for Dan?
So it seems that the basic premise of all this work is that if I collide two particles with a small enough impact parameter enough energy that I'm going to form a black hole, but the particles that I know tend to be rather large, and even if they had enough energy, they hit directly on, the actual size of the particle is much greater than that.
No, but the wave function, I mean, the wave function will be more and more narrow with energy, so it's not going to be spread out. So, I mean, that's one thing. But another thing, electrons, for example, I mean, we still don't have a, they might be point-like.
Well, I understand, but when I collide electrons at high energy, I tend to produce a shower of all kinds of things. If I, as opposed to producing a mini black hole, I'm producing many other particles.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's why I used the word Hoppe conjecture, but I should have been more precise. People were not happy with the Hoppe conjecture in collision of two particles precisely because of your argument. But then there is a work by Giddings and Erderly. They wrote a very nice paper. Exactly when people started raising that point, they really showed if you collide two particles at trans-Planckian energies, an apparent horizon forms. You can show that global horizon forms, but an apparent horizon forms. Because, again, you are concentrating all of that energy within its own Schwarzschild radius. So, yeah, at lower energies, you produce showers of particles, blah, blah, blah. Once you cross the threshold, once you compress it to a region smaller than its own Schwarzschild radius, you make a black hole. And there is numerical work confirming that. It's not just a conjecture. So there is numerical evidence for it.
Okay, just to follow up on that. I guess I don't understand. So it seems to me that this whole, everything you're talking about basically requires assuming that a GR line works arbitrarily small down, or at least for Planckian black holes and even things well below that. The normal, the standard line, including by Giddings, would be, okay, this is all trustworthy, assuming we're, you know, at least an order of magnitude bigger than the Planck scale. Then this, the classical one will be reasonable, and we can talk about black holes.
Yeah.
If it's at or below that scale, well, certainly the string people would say, well, it actually forms a highly excited string. I mean, it's something, at a minimum, your quantum theory of gravity comes into play, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So I don't understand. So what's the regime of validity you think is it, or are you just assuming it's GR all the way down?
Two answers to your question. So one, with the same argument, you can kill the whole industry of the LHC, which is looking for mini black holes. Because
that was always wishful thinking in the first place.
I mean, but that's what you want. You push the envelope. That's what is sometimes called, I'm not sure if everybody's going to agree, radical conservatism. Take the things that you well understand. Push them as far as you can and see what happens. Rather than saying, oh, I don't know what's quantum gravity, let's go and fish. That's the alternative. So take the things that you understand well, calculate, don't speculate, calculate, and see where you are going to end up. That's the philosophy. That's one thing. And second is that about the quantum corrections, yeah, you need order of two magnitudes. Yeah, that's correct. Though, once you are over the threshold, over the Planckian mass, then it becomes a classical regime, at least semi-classical, but classic. That's why these are not black.
Order magnitude over, then that's probably reasonable. I think you don't have any objection.
Yeah.
It's close. I don't know what it is. I don't think anybody does.
Then, by the same argument, you can say, why are we talking about inflation and all of the other things? Maybe quantum gravity, once we formulate it, will resolve everything. It doesn't make sense to talk about the origin of the universe, and we don't have quantum gravity, so just, no, you can't believe anything. So maybe FRW metric is not correct at early times, close to Planckian times. So, so you can't do that. You have to take what you have at hand, calculate something, and see what you're going to get, if it makes sense or it doesn't.
I would say when you do any calculation, you have to understand the regime where it applies.
I prefer to push the things as far as I can until they clearly break. That's my personal point of view.
So,
rather than give up ahead of time.
So I guess, I mean, just to find a common ground between you guys, as hard as it was out. So there is indeed a regime where you could form black holes where we understand everything, right? So as long as there are things in the tail of the distribution at even low temperatures that have high energies and they can come close to each other, so you could form black holes, even very small probability. But then over time, there would be more and more black holes that will form, because if you can wait long enough.
Yeah.
So in fact, that's an interesting, that kind of reminds me a little bit of the fireball paradox, because it's a system that's low temperature. If you just wait long enough, you're going to basically start, well, seeing quantum gravity.
That's possible.
So that's just a question of how long you have to wait, and even though everything is low energy there. So, any other questions? John?
In physics, we appeal to experimental physics, to learn about physics. And in this case, we know nothing about quantum gravity, as far as experimental physics is concerned.
Yeah.
We know very little about black holes. So, we can't appeal to experimental physics to decide any of your issues here.
Yeah.
Which is a pity. Eventually, in the future, beyond my lifetime, we'll know something.
You are right. So I was talking about effects that appear either at Planck temperature or at Poincaré recurrence time order of magnitude, which is unfathomably big. Yeah.
Okay, so if there are no other questions, Dan is here for the day, and his office is 333. Okay, well, let's thank him again.